Well, good morning, everyone. Lesson 9. We're continuing to talk about man being made to the image and likeness of God. And it's remarkable that if you look at just the text of Scripture, we are talking about a verse. And this is something that Gregory of Nyssa will get pages and pages and pages out of the verse. Because how we're made to the image and likeness of God, that takes a lot of unpacking. We started first by talking about how we're made to the image and likeness of God in our soul, how the powers of mind and will make us like God. But there are ways in which our body shows how we are made to the image and likeness of God, because we have a body that fits with our rational soul. Most of the chapter that you read from St. Gregory of Nyssa talks about the upright posture that we have, that we are meant to be upright, and the significance, and that's what I'll be spending most of my time on. Last time, what I talked about was the relation of human beings to animals, and a sign that we are meant to be in charge of nature, that we're stewards over nature, is the power that we have over animals. St. Augustine has this very simple formula that we are the lords of nature is evident in the fact that we domesticate animals, and animals are not domesticating us. We're not able to obviously domesticate all the animals. We're not domesticating cockroaches and mosquitoes. But there are animals that they are in the form they are because of basically 40 to 60,000 years of human intervention. So the domesticated dog, the domesticated sheep, horses, these have all been bred in various ways by human intelligence. And one of the things I talked about last time, the Epicureans, remember, they believed that there really was no divine providence, that nature was just something that unfolded according to atoms, according to chance. And if anything, when you look at human beings, they don't look providentially made. They come into the world without horns or wings or stingers or any of that. So they look like they've just been sort of thrown onto the earth unprovided for. Remember, Lactantius has this lovely phrase, which is the Epicurean summary. Nature is not a mother, but a stepmother. Right? Think of Cinderella, like the stepmother in Cinderella. That's what nature is like. Trying to keep you from the ball and substitute those nasty stepsisters of yours instead. Nature is giving, in other words, all these things to the other animals. They can run and hunt and fly, but humans and bite and sting, but human beings cannot. And remember, the response to that is, Origen makes the response, it's providence that in fact we have to develop all those things for ourselves. That nature gives us mind, nature gives us ingenuity and invention, and that's how you get arts of geometry, that's how you get arts of astronomy. All those things start with necessity. Geometry doesn't start with people just wondering about the properties of circles, triangles, and squares. It's because the Egyptians had to resurvey their land every time the Nile flooded. But from that, you get geometry eventually. When people developed, were watching the stars and recording things astronomically, again, it wasn't because of an interest in how the planets moved and plotting out their orbits. No, they needed an accurate calendar to predict the coming of the rains, or to predict the flooding of the Nile. They need to know when things happen. But out of that, you get things like Ptolemy and Copernicus and Kepler and all the rest of it. Those necessities force the development of the mind. Okay, so in that part, there's the how the arts, in a way, show the gifts that we have that are unique to us. The animals, beavers can build dams and bees can build beehives and so on, but that's it. It's all instinctive for them. It's all programmed. They can't adapt. You can drop human beings anywhere. They can become cliff dwellers. They can build igloos. They can they can burrow underground. They can build skyscrapers. That's what mind, that's what intellect allows you to do. So now we're going to be focusing on the body. And one of the questions that I had for you, this term that we're very used to that goes back to Pope John Paul II, these Wednesday audiences that he gave in the late 70s, the theology of the body. One of the things that I asked you to reflect on is when you read St. Gregory of Nyssa here, you are getting a theology of the body. What you get in John Paul II is a focus on human sexuality. But that is not all there is to the human body. There are all sorts of things to reflect on in our humanity which point upwards. They point upwards. John Paul II, writing as he does in the later 70s, is focusing on human sexuality because that's the thing that modern people are so confused about or so wrongheaded about. I think it was Fulton Sheehan who talked about how it is that, you know, the world complains because the church is always talking about sex. But the problem is that the world is always talking about sex and we have to respond to it. There are so many of these things, in fact, that the church teaching is simple, beautiful. It doesn't actually take pages and pages and hours, but the church and people who serve the church are forced to keep addressing every new aberration that comes along. And so, therefore, it looks like that's what our mind is on. So, for the purpose of drawing more out of this, I invite you to think about how it is that our upright posture, the fact that we are not as animals down to the earth, but that we are, in the words of, I think this is Erwin Strauss, who I'll talk about in a bit, we are meant to look outward and upward. That has theological implications. We are not just focused on the ground. We are not just focused on our next meal or our next mate or our next enemy. It makes perfect sense that animals, given the goods that they seek, are focused on the ground. We are meant for more than that. And you can see that in our very posture. Now, before I develop that, I do want to mention these two folks who I'll be drawing on. André Leroy-Guron, French archaeologist. What else did he do? Paleontology. He is somebody whose works were on prehistoric man and especially prehistoric art and prehistoric technology. He's obviously French. No, he's French. And he was at the Sorbonne in Paris and in the College of France. And he writes this book, Gesture and Speech, in 1964, which is all about these unique human powers of speech and what we're able to do with our hands. It's a whole, and that when human beings develop those, that's a breakthrough in evolutionary history, and that's the beginning, really, of human prehistory. The other thing that I'll be referring to is this short work by Erwin Strauss, Upright Posture. Strauss was a psychiatrist, psychologist, and he was a part of the package of these people that we refer to as God's, or we refer to as Hitler's gift to America. All these educated German Jews who fled in the 1930s and came over and populated Princeton, Harvard, the University of Chicago, the New School. He ended up in Kentucky State, of all places. Yeah, you don't expect the Berlin educated psychiatrist to end up in Frankfort, Kentucky, but there it is. But in this short work about upright posture, he talks about how fundamental our upright posture is to our lived experience as human beings. And it's a remarkable work. It's the thing of Strauss's that people, when they know one thing of Strauss, this is usually the thing they know, is this upright posture article. In any event, here's the phrases that I just used. That being upright means that we are outward and upward, not just downward. One of the things that Strauss will talk about is if you think about an animal goes along, going on all fours, goes along a horizontal plane where basically food in, waste out, and it's always moving in the plane of that direction of receiving food, getting rid of waste. Whereas human beings are not on a horizontal plane. We are up and down. So our focus, even in our very animality, is not simply on nourishing ourselves or avoiding obstacles or whatnot. By being put upright, there's simply more of the world that we're meant to focus on. For animals are always what's in front of me. The world of being an animal is a world of immediacy. If there's nothing around to get your dog hungry to eat, or some stranger that he's going to bark, what often does your dog do? Your dog tends to power down. And then once something comes into his world, someone drives up in the driveway, someone comes to visit, you get the bag of dog food, vroom, now he comes back online. But before those things, right, he just sort of powers down. Because he is moved around in his world by these basic goods of food or possible danger, and that's all there, in a way, is to his world. Whereas a human being upright, you are being lifted above those immediate things. And even in terms of your experience of the world, you are meant to look beyond. You are meant to look around. The very word theoretical, that comes from a Greek word which means looking around. That you are the kind of animal that looks around, you take in your surroundings, and now you're just thinking about those surroundings. You're not necessarily looking for food, looking for enemies, looking for mates. That you are looking outward toward the world. I have two church fathers here, Cyprian of Carthage and Lactantius, and both of them are talking about this theological significance of being upright. So first, Cyprian of Carthage. God made you upright, while other animals are down-looking and depressed in posture, bending toward the earth. Yours is a lofty attitude, and your countenance is raised upright to heaven and to God. Look there. Lift your eyes upward. Seek God in the highest, that you may be free from things below. Lift your heart to a dependence on high and heavenly things. Why do you prostrate yourself into the ruin of death with the serpent whom you worship? Why do you fall into the destruction of the devil by his means and in his company? Keep the lofty estate into which you were born. Right? That being upright puts us in the position of looking upward, of thinking on high, of thinking of these things that are meant to be above. Again, you can think of that physically, that you can take in more about your world than you would if you were pointed down. But obviously this is also meant as an image of thinking of things that are outside the world of your sensual experience, that now you are thinking of things that are spiritual, that are beyond the realm of just sensual experience. Lactantius. Lactantius is, if you recall, we heard about him last week. This is the one who responds to the objection of the Epicureans that human beings have just been left, orphan. Here's Lactantius. For if we look to heaven, it is undoubtedly for no other reason than on account of religion. If religion is taken away, then we have nothing to do with heaven. Therefore, we must either look in that direction or bend down to the earth. We are not able to bend down to the earth, even if we should wish, since our posture is upright. We must therefore look up to heaven, to which the nature of the body calls us. Okay? Think about that. That the very fact that we're upright, Lactantius is saying, should tell us that we're meant to look heavenward, that we're meant to be above the goods that are merely the goods of animals. This is what I mean by theology of the body. Remember, the point of those Wednesday audiences and reflections, John Paul was trying to help us see that in our very physicality of as man and woman, that we weren't just animals mating, that there was something about our physicality in the union of man and woman which pointed to something sacramental, something beyond just the mere sexual union that of mating that you would have with animals. But What you're seeing here with St. Gregory of Nyssa, it isn't just that realm. Even the very fact of your upright posture points to something spiritual, points to something heavenly. That's what I mean by a theology of the body. An indication in the very body itself that we are above the animals and pointed to goods that are beyond mere animal goods. A key part of St. Gregory of Nyssa is his talking about our hands. And I talked about that last time, but let me spend a little more time on it now. I introduced how it is that Aristotle will talk about the hand as the organ of organs, or if you like, the tool of tools. That the hand is what allows you not just to use things as tools, but to make tools. When you look at higher primates, they look like they have hands, and they may even have something like an opposable thumb. But they don't have an opposable thumb to the degree that human beings do. So if I had, here we go, we have to pretend that this is something like a hammer. This is something, pretend this is something big. Okay? So if I'm holding this, notice I have a power grip. If you're a gorilla, you're a chimpanzee, you can't do that. You can't wrap your fingers around something in a way that allows for a power grip, that allows a firm grip on something. You're not going to be able to get a gorilla to get a baseball bat and, like, you know, hit one out to shallow center. It's just not going to happen for the gorilla. Conversely, the kind of opposable thumb you have allows you a precision grip. This is what allows you to have good penmanship, or, right, make a precision cut with, like, a little razor or whatnot. Okay? So they have thumbs, and yes, they're kind of opposable, but not to the extent that they are for a human being. Think about how basic those things are, that you're able to hold something with strength and wield it with some kind of accuracy, but also that you're able to hold things and make precision movements with them, like a pen or a knife. Okay? Now, Aristotle will take up this position of this earlier Greek thinker, Anaxagoras. Anaxagoras will say, why are we rational? We are rational because we have hands. Because we are the animal that developed hands, and so this animal that developed hands is going to be the animal that becomes rational. In other words, Anaxagoras looks for some kind of material natural cause and then gets intellect or mind out of that. And Aristotle says, that does not make sense. It makes sense that the being that has the ability is the one who, right, is the one who has the right tools. You're the carpenter, you're the contractor, you got the big truck with the toolboxes in it, right? Because you've got that skill. It makes no sense for you to have all that stuff if you don't have the ability. So Aristotle says, we do not have reason because we have hands. We have hands because we have reason. It's the ability that creates the tools and allows them to be tools. Okay? In a way, what you're getting with Anaxagoras is you're getting this sort of naturalist view that matter develops in certain ways and then, boop, right, you have these abilities that spring out of it. In other words, you always want to look to nature and material causes as making things the way they are. But what Aristotle is pointing out is that, no, you've got to have the human rational nature first. And then that's what allows the hands to be useful. That power grip or precision grip is not what's going to make you intellectual. It's being intellectual, being rational, that allows that ability to be useful. It's a fitting one for you to have. Okay. This, by the way, is in the Parts of Animals, Book 4, Chapter 10. And just a little side thing on Aristotle. You know, Aristotle is somebody that maybe you, if you have any associations with him, you think of, well, there's the Nicomachean Ethics. I know he wrote this work on ethics. There's this book of his on first philosophy, on metaphysics. But he's like one of these philosophers, and you just think, isn't he some guy who like walks around in a toga and he says wise things, and the students are like following him around, and maybe he turns around and they all part so that he can walk through as they're... Okay, no. Aristotle, 25% of Aristotle's written works are studies on animals. This is the father of biology. Aristotle is the father of biology. And he has philosophic concepts that he's bringing to his study of animals. But he will sit there for pages and pages and just start and talk about the different traits that animals have, different behaviors that they have. The difference with Aristotle is he is not going to look at those behaviors and traits as if they develop by chance over time. He is always going to look at those behaviors and traits and say, this is part of the package of what this animal is. And this is what allows it to survive and survive the way it does. So that you have humans with hands, that's part of the package of being human. And it makes no sense to talk about there being, as it were, pre-human, proto-human things that somehow changes in their body are what allow them to have intelligence. In fact, Aristotle has a little treatise on generation of animals. And when it comes to the human soul, Aristotle will say, because the human soul is rational and immaterial, the human soul alone comes from without. In other words, Aristotle, 2,400 years ago, is saying, Mama and Papa are not the ones who are giving you your soul. Right? With a mama dog, papa dog, that's where the puppies come from, and that's all there is to say. Mama cat and papa cat, that's where the kittens come from. That's all there is to say. But because you have a soul, not like that, you have a soul that has a mind and will and is immaterial, that is being infused. That is being infused. That is coming. Now, Aristotle doesn't have the idea of God that we do. He doesn't have some kind of Father, Son, Holy Spirit, Creator God. He doesn't have any of that. But he knows that there is some divine power out there that must be the source of human ensoulment. Okay. Allow me to say as an aside, one of the people that I read when I was in graduate school with great, who was helpful in so many ways, Werner Heisenberg. Werner Heisenberg is famous, along with Niels Bohr, with coming up with quantum mechanics. In other words, the movement of subatomic particles. And that stuff all involves heavy math. I struggled with algebra too, so it's not the mathematical stuff of Heisenberg that I learned from. It's the series of books that he wrote. One of them is called Physics and Philosophy, Physics and Beyond. And what he does in these books is talks about what it is from the history of human thinking about nature, going back to the pre-Socratics, Plato, Aristotle, the early moderns like Galileo and Kepler, what those folks still have to teach us. There's so many people in the sciences that their idea is, what's happened in the last 20 years, that's all you got to know. And everything before that is sort of like ignorance. You always want to be up to date on the latest thing. That tends to be the culture of the sciences. Here's Werner Heisenberg, pioneer physicist, developer, along with Niels Bohr, of this whole new way of understanding matter. And in this, I think it's Physics and Beyond, which is largely autobiographical, he says, how did I first get on the track of thinking about the ultimate particles of matter? When I was in high school, my father was a professor of classics, and he handed me Plato's Timaeus, which is this dialogue about how everything is made from geometrical shapes. So the ultimate particles are triangles and different kinds of triangles and squares and things like that. It's wild. But he said, I remember being on the roof of my high school and reading this, of course reading it in Greek, because that was how they read Plato in the 1930s in a German gymnasium, right? German private high school. They're reading everything in Greek and Latin. He's up there working his way through Plato, just thinking this is so wild that he has all these mathematical explanations for where matter comes from. And he said, That moment, I can remember the moment, that was what put me on the path. And Heisenberg will talk about how it is that people in the modern sciences, they think it's all about evidence, data, experiments. We just pile up the information. And he said, to do great science, it isn't just having data and facts. It's having ideas and concepts to make sense of those facts. And he says, when you look at the early Greek natural philosophers, so Anaxagoras and Thales and Heraclitus and Democritus, they have all the basic ideas that we're still using today. Democritus is talking about atoms. Heraclitus is talking about energy and matter. Anaxagoras is talking about mind and body parts. Empedocles has this idea of things, animals arising at random, and once certain animals die off and other animals survive. Empedocles already has this idea of mutations and those mutations surviving. Now, they didn't have all the microscopes and telescopes. They didn't have all the equipment. They didn't have the labs that we have. But if you were talking about the basic ideas that you need to understand the natural world, it's all there. People came up, the Greeks came up, other cultures came up with all these basic ideas. And that is a constant source of refreshment for scientists. It's not enough to just have evidence. What does it mean? What are different ways of thinking about the evidence? What are different ways of explaining? The evidence doesn't give you that. The evidence doesn't give you different ways of explaining. It's the human mind that has to come up with different ways of explaining. Okay, let's go to this this part of this last part in St. Gregory of Nyssa, where he's talking about the development of the hands and the development of speech. And it's very striking because Gregory talks about how it is. Look it's the reading. It's the, you just mark it for yourself. It's the on 45. It's the second to last paragraph. If man were destitute of hands, the various parts of his face would certainly have been arranged like those of quadrupeds to suit the purpose of his feeding. So its form would have been lengthened out and pointed toward the nostrils. His lips would have been projected from his mouth, lumpy and stiff and thick, fitted for taking up grass. His tongue would have either lain between his teeth or of a kind to match his lips, fleshy and hard and rough, assisting the teeth to deal with what came under his grinder, or would have been moist and hanging out the side like dogs and other carnivorous beasts projecting through the gaps of his jagged row of teeth. Okay, horrible to think upon, is it not? So in this book of Leroy Garron, Gesture and Speech, there are two different places where he gives this hat tip to St. Gregory of Nyssa. So let me share this with you. He quotes the thing that I just read to you, right? Quotes the whole thing that I just read to you. And this is what he says. There is little we can add to this quotation except by commenting in the language of the 20th century upon what was already evident 1,600 years ago. Though it arrives to the same conclusion by a different path from St. Gregory of Nyssa, paleontology, too, speaks in terms of a release, a liberation, within a perspective which starts with a fish in the Paleozoic era, ends with a human in the Quaternary period. It is though we were witnessing a series of successive liberations. Okay, so here's the key point. That of the whole body from the liquid element, that of the head from the ground, that of the hand from the requirements of locomotion, and finally that of the brain from the facial mask. Okay, so in other words, that when you look at, if you were to just take at face value the development that you see in the fossil record all through history and through leading up to man, he talks about it as a series of liberations, that you would be able to get animals out of the water, that you would be able to get animals, up from the ground, that you would free the hand, that you would free the face, right? It's as if human beings are the end of this process of nature freeing itself from the water, from the earth, to something above those things. Okay. Here's later on, he returns to Gregory of Nyssa. Contemporary paleontology and zoology demonstrate this in the case of ungulates, like cows and so on. Absence of a hand's intervention is in fact compensated by extremely varied facial specialization. Not only are very complex forms found in the dental organization of a horse or an elephant, but also other facial organs show considerable structural diversity, which to some extent makes up for the forelimbs deficiency. In other words, if you don't have hands, now all of a sudden your face has to do all the work. You don't quite have a face anymore because you're going to have a snout or a, right? And conversely, once you have hands, that frees up the face to do all sorts of things. Okay? Gregory of Nyssa's explanation, of course, cannot be taken literally. The remarkable thing is at the end of the 4th century AD, a philosopher should have sensed so distinctly the relationship between speech and hand. We should note, too, that he does not see the relationship as the commonplace one where the hand participates in speech through gesticulation. In other words, the hand is assisting the mouth because, like, you're gesturing or waving or doing that sort of thing. No, he sees this relationship as an organic one. Manual expertise corresponding to the degree of freedom of operation of the facial organs now made available for speech. Okay? So the fact that you have been put upright means that now your hands can be hands, not just sort of, as it were, almost like additional feet, and that your face can now be a face. It isn't going to be something where it's having to do the work that your hands would be doing. Right? If a dog's going to grab something, it's got to do everything with its mouth. Or an elephant, right? It has to use its trunk. The face, the front of the head, has to do all that work. Whereas to have hands, you are freed for that. And now the face can do what? It can have a mouth that is able to talk. So I know before I read this, I don't know that I as clearly recognized the relationship among all those things. Standing upright, with having tool-making hands, with having verbalization that now allows you to express your intellectual ideas. But this is what we mean by talking about how the whole body proclaims that man is made to his image and likeness. It's because you're rational that you're upright. It's because you're rational that you're able to talk. It's because you're rational that you're able to have hands. And these are the kind of things that we just take for granted because, of course, we're using them all the time. But like our intellectual ability, that isn't something that the other animals have. You have been put upright because you have that special gift. Okay? Erwin Strauss will talk about just all the things that are involved once you see that it's so fundamental to human life. The way that you will talk about being an upright person. The way that you will talk about moral goodness as being upright. And that when you talk about bad behavior or corruption, there's a falling away, right? There's a falling down. There's a stumbling. Strauss will talk about how it is that, just think of the challenge that there is for us as human beings. When you are on four legs, you are very stable. We basically get across the room by a series of stopping ourselves falling. Every step is a step where you could possibly fall in a way that's not as true for a horse or a dog or any other four-legged animal. That you have to learn to walk. That as a baby, you're crawling. And one of the first stages of maturity is that you are able to get on your two legs and make it across. Think with your children about what a milestone it is that once especially that first baby takes its first steps, you are on the phone to your parents, you are calling everybody, you're inundating them with pictures. That is a big deal because this is one of the decisive steps of being human. That you are able to be upright and keep yourself upright. Okay? Strauss will talk about how it is that, in a way, being upright is a struggle. It's always easier to lie down. It's always easier to sleep. Think sometimes about the challenge of just like getting yourself out of bed, getting yourself upright and staying upright. There's this constant sense that part of the human condition involves pushing against gravity in a way that for the other animals, they don't have to push as much. To, in other words, to have a mind, to have a spiritual part of you, then therefore involves this struggle to lift yourself up from the earth and lift yourself up from the ground. Strauss, by the way, is the one who mentions that you can read people who will talk about upright posture as a sign that of a jury-rigged human being. This is a sign that, you know, we are evolved. What creator would make us like this? Because of course when you're upright, flat feet, right? You have fallen arches. That's one of the hazards. Hernias. You get hernias because your intestines are up and down. They're not side to side, right? Animals aren't going to get hernias that way. And childbirth. If you are going to have a narrower pelvis to be able to be bipedal, the ratio of pelvis to baby's head shrinks. It becomes a harder task. If you look at the way that gorillas give birth, that didn't look that hard. I mean, really, mama gorilla basically reaches between her legs and just pulls out baby. It's amazing to see. Dang! why doesn't it look like that for us? Because you're upright with a narrower pelvis. That's why. So you could come up with all those things and say, well, if there's a God out there, I mean, why didn't he make it right? Because, again, the basic principle that you have to remember is that God is working with nature, with all of nature's limitations. So he's not going to make something, as it were, supernaturalized. He's not going to make some kind of supernaturalized perfection. We are being made in the way that fits with, right, our animal condition. The parallel that St. Thomas will make is when the craftsman makes a knife of iron or steel or some kind of metal, he's fully aware that he needs something hard, he needs something sharpened, but he's making it from a material that can rust. If he could somehow keep it from rusting or help slow down the rusting, he will. But that's part of the package of working with metal. Likewise, if we are going to be made from flesh and bone and gravity is going to be operating, then there are going to be those drawbacks. The idea is not that we are being made as perfect creatures, but we're being made the best that nature allows. Now, in a glorified body, are you going to have fallen arches and hernias and childbirth? No. So it's not that there won't be a condition that will come to. But we are going to pass through nature first to that supernaturalized condition. We have a little time. Were there things as you read that you wanted to ask about or argue with or complain about? Or go ahead, Mrs. Bettina.
Where were you going on the fairy tale thing?
Yeah.
about transforming, because it was a fairy tale.
Oh, the question. There was a question.
Why is it impossible for humans to transform into animals like they do in fairy tales, but a fairy tale isn't impossible. It's just a fairy tale.
Well, the point being, when you have C.S. Lewis, when C.S. Lewis was growing up, he loved Wind in the Willows, you know, and Wind in the Willows is full of talking animals. So what is the problem with a talking animal? What's the problem with that? Yep.
Their body structure isn't right for that.
Yeah, you are throwing something human into a body that isn't human. So you can just sort of make it work imaginatively. But really, if you had the power of reason and you had the power of speech, what a punishment it would be to be stuck in a goose. What a punishment it would be to be stuck in a badger or a bear. So when you read that in CS, when you read it in Narnia, yeah, it's Mr. and Mrs. Beaver kind of come off as people. But if you think about what beavers actually have and what they do, you know, you really have to end up humanizing them to have that work. The beavers are wearing clothes, and they really have more hands than claws. And think about Mr. Toad and Toad Hall driving his car. If he really had a frog shape, would he be able to drive his car, right? In fact, the fairy tales and things like Wind in the Willows and Chronicles of Narnia, they show you that once you drop a human soul in something, it starts pushing everything else into a human body. So that was what was behind it. Yeah. Very good. So next week we will be talking about, no, not soul. We will be talking about the nuptial meaning of the body. We will be talking about male and female. He made them, so we'll be covering that then. But I wanted to start with this, because this is the more basic way that the body points upwards in the way we're made. Very good. Next week. Oh, sorry, what? Sorry.
I just wanted to ask Dr.
How do I not notice Mrs. Methuen? I mean, she's... Yeah. Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask Dr. Bull, do you ever teach Aristotle at the field of biology?
I started to 2 years ago. Yep. I'm doing a lot more intentional... I'm basically in the process of developing... intentionally using core aspects of philosophy to connect biology to our Catholic faith.
Very good. Thank you. See you next week.